So now on to the second keynote speaker, Constanti Gebert. The only thing I can say is that Costa told us right from the beginning that Poland has too much history to digest. But as far as I'm concerned, there is no way that one can hear Gebert too often. There's no way to absorb all the wisdom, the interpretations, the sense of history, and the profound moral resource that he brings. So it is really a great pleasure to introduce him to you.
Don't believe anything this lady tells you. If you want to know what it means to hear me too often speak to my children. I'd like to begin by taking issue with the topic of my presentation, as it's formulated in the program, Jews and Poles, shared history with divergent narratives. What I'll be arguing is that Jews and Poles have been fooled into believing that just because they share a geography, they also share a history. In fact, they don't. There are two histories which at times run parallel, at times blend into one, at times are widely divergent. And one of the fundamental reasons why Jews and Poles find it even today so hard to dialogue is precisely this. We know different histories. And it's not only about divergent interpretations of this and that, this is run-of-the-mill, this is what history is all about, this is what makes it so fascinating. It is about fundamental inability to agree about what happened and what it meant. So let me start by giving you some examples of what I mean. They're both taken from World War II, because this is where this divergent history is at its most vivid and still today most powerful. In late March 1943, Kazik Ratajzer, a member of the Jewish Fighting Organization, was smuggled out of the Warsaw Ghetto through the sewers to what was called the Aryan side of the city in a desperate attempt to buy more weapons for the uprising that was forthcoming. He was unsuccessful, and he observed the uprising from the Aryan side, eventually smuggling himself back in to lead his comrades, his surviving comrades, out into the relative safety of the Aryan side after the fall of the uprising. But when he was smuggled out and taken to a clandestine apartment, washed up, given new clothes, he emerged on the Warsaw street, and years later, he would describe his first walk down the street on the Aryan side for the first time in 2.5 years since the city had been divided by the Germans in two by the ghetto wall. This was the first time Kazik Ratajzer could walk the streets of Warsaw. And he said, Warsaw was a city at peace. Girls were walking down the avenues with bouquets of flowers in their hand. People were sitting in coffee shops and drinking tea. A little orchestra was playing in the park. Warsaw was a city at peace. And yes, coming from the Warsaw Ghetto, the so-called Aryan side of Warsaw was a city at peace. There were no flowers in the ghetto. Some of you might have seen a fascinating documentary film by Yael Chersonsky called Unfinished Film, which is a contemporary commentary about German propaganda films shot in the ghetto. And those are commented by some survivors. And there's a scene in one of the German propaganda films which shows a Jewish woman in the ghetto arranging a bouquet of flowers. And the survivor says, there were no flowers. We would have eaten them. So no, there were no flowers in the ghetto. No trees, no blades of grass. And here girls were walking around with bouquets. People wouldn't sit on a street side coffee shop. Too risky. A passing German soldier might take the fancy of taking a pot shot. These actually happened. They would have little hunting parties entering the ghetto and competing in marksmanship. There was an orchestra playing, but it wouldn't play in the park. There was no park. And most importantly, you didn't trip over dead bodies. The ghetto was a place which was constructed to murder. It was its purpose and was very efficient at that. On the quote-unquote Aryan side of the ghetto wall, murder was still the exception, not the rule. From where Kazik Ratajzer was coming, yes, Warsaw was a city at peace. The difference between the ghetto side of the wall and the quote-unquote Aryan side of the wall, separating two parts of the same city, was greater than the difference between occupied Warsaw and occupied Paris, or even free London. The ghetto belonged to a separate universe. It shared that space with German and Soviet concentration camps. The distance between the two sides of the ghetto was about 0.5 feet, the average width of the ghetto wall. The distance in experience was light years. But to call occupied Warsaw in the spring of 43 a city at peace, you had to come from the universe of death. April 43 is a period of increased German repression in Warsaw. It first means the roundups. Entire blocks would be locked up and men, able-bodied men, dragged away for slave labor in Germany. If they were lucky, they were able to send word to their families. As often as not, their families only after the war, when they were reunited or not, discovered what happened to the brother, son, or husband who simply didn't return from the street a bright April day. This was the time when the first mass executions took place. When you'd be walking around the city, you might notice plaques on the wall with a kind of Maltese cross on them and inscriptions. These mark the main execution sites. I remember when I first went to Paris, how envious I was seeing the plaques on the street that would say, "Ici est mort le compagnon de libération." Here was killed the companion of liberation. This is the official title the French give to their resistance heroes. And then it would give the name, the age, and the date. Our plaques say, here on such and such a date, the Germans killed approximately 100 Poles. We don't even have the names. Nobody living in occupied Warsaw would have entertained the fantasy that this was a city at peace. Had Kazik told that to anybody, they would be offended. There was no way somebody experiencing the unspeakable suffering of living in occupied Warsaw to imagine that there could be suffering greater. It was extremely difficult for anybody emerging from the unimaginable hell of the ghetto to understand that this too is suffering. This is not a question of interpretation, it's a question of radical differentiation of experience. This goes on, this difference in the understanding of the experience, to the post-war times. Poles find it very difficult to understand the difference in the nature of the Polish and the Jewish suffering. A Pole will say, okay, 3 million Polish Jews were killed, 3 million non-Jewish Poles were killed. We're equal. The difference is that the Jews were supposed to be murdered down to the last child hiding in the woods, and it almost happened. The Poles were, quote-unquote, only to be reduced to slave labor and systematically killed, and even this failed. From the Polish perspective, it is very difficult to imagine a suffering that is greater. From a Jewish perspective, it is difficult to appreciate the immensity of Polish suffering. We start talking at cross purposes. Another example, September 17th, 1939. Professor Stola yesterday reminded us that in September 39, Poland was invaded by both its neighbors and partitioned. And when Soviet troops entered eastern Poland, very often they were met by small groups of cheering Jewish inhabitants. This is a fact that is remembered in both in Polish and in Jewish memoirs of the period, historically incontrovertible, although, of course, the debate is open about how big were those groups, how representative, and why that happened. But frankly, when I think of myself, had I been there, September 17, 39, in Lwów, in Drohobycz, in Stryj, in Grodno, Nowogródek, any of the towns invaded by the Soviets, I can imagine I would be out there on the street cheering, yes. First, it was the Red Army and not the Wehrmacht. By mid-September, there was nothing else in the menu. Poland was defeated. It knew it was defeated. It knew it cannot count on its allies. So the question was, is it better to be invaded by the Russians or by the Germans? There wasn't much difference from a Polish perspective. There was an ocean of a difference from a Jewish perspective. Yes, it was better to have the Red Army. So one reason to cheer is we have the Red Army, therefore we don't have the Wehrmacht. Another reason to cheer was that Poland had been making it very explicit it doesn't want its Jewish citizens. There was no small element of schadenfreude, of satisfaction from somebody else's misfortune that Jews felt, a quote that often returns is Jews telling their Polish acquaintances, you wanted Poland without the Jews? Well, you get the Jews without the Poland. Serves you right. Not a very nice feeling. And when we think of it, pretty stupid, but pretty understandable. After the mistreatment and discrimination that Jews had suffered in Poland. And yes, there were those who actually thought that becoming part of the Soviet Union will be an improvement. They weren't the only ones. Great intellectuals were fooled. Great intellectuals would go and visit the Soviet Union and write back, I saw the future and it works. But the practical test was, in the officers, among the officers of that invading army, there were Jews. No Jew could make it officer in the Polish army. Empirical, practical proof that the Soviet Union will be better. From what we know today, this was naive, stupid, deluded, but not evil. Except if you were a non-Jewish Pole and you watched your neighbors cheering an invading army. For those non-Jewish Poles, what they were seeing is treason. If the word has meaning, this is what they were seeing. An invading army is entering, and my neighbors are cheering it. Again, there is no way we can negotiate a compromise vision of September 17th. The perfectly legitimate reasons for Jews to cheer, and one has to have to make the footnote that those Jews cheering were probably not representative for the community as a whole. I find it very difficult to imagine that there were Jewish property owners who cheered the fact that their property will be taken away from them. Rabbis will be cheering the fact that the synagogue will be closed. Zionists will be cheering the fact that they'll be sent to Siberia. I'd rather expect the people who were out of the cheering were highly unrepresentative of the community, but that wouldn't have mattered for their non-Jewish neighbors watching them through semi-closed windows and witnessing treason. Now, though there cannot be a compromise position on this, it is well worth reminding that 2 years later, when the Germans invaded, most everybody cheered. After 2 years of Soviet occupation, everybody stupidly believed that it can't get worse, that the Germans will be liberating us from the Soviets. Ukrainians cheered because they expected the Germans would give them an independent state. Poles cheered because they thought that the Germans would be beating the Russians and nothing can be worse than the Russians. Okay, the Jews didn't cheer. For once, the situation was reversed. The Jews had no reason to believe that the invading army would be an improvement. But many people fell into the delusion that the plague will be better than the cholera, or vice versa, depending on what your epidemiological preference is. Now, if you try to have a good dialogue, a genuine dialogue, you sit down and the other guy tells you the story from his perspective. It is so outrageously different from what you have learned, from what you know, that you have to assume that the other guy is lying and knows he is lying. Again, this is not a question of interpretation. Either compared to the ghetto, Warsaw was a city at peace, or it wasn't. Either on September 17, the cheering Jews were committing treasons, or they weren't. Very little middle ground there. And very little possibility of convincing the other guy that he might be not entirely right in his perspective. Because the other guy's grandfather was there and he saw it. Don't tell me nonsense, mister. Grandfather told me he was there. You can't win an argument against grandfather. And it's a good thing. I actually prefer to live in a society when people trust what their grandfathers told them about the world, that in a society in which a foreigner, smooth-talking, can talk you out of your loyalty to grandfather. Point is, you're not talking to grandfather anymore. Had he been there at that table, he would have probably recognized that although, yes, this is the story, it's not the entire story. There's more to it. Happily or unhappily, he would be forced to concede that his side wasn't exactly right all of the time either. He actually, with a shot of vodka or two, might be convinced into telling the good stories that didn't get passed on to his grandson because the bad stories were so powerful. Grandfather isn't there anymore. You're arguing against his ghost inhabiting the mind of his grandson. You can't win that argument. And it goes on into almost every aspect of the deeply contested Polish-Jewish relationship. It is only now, in the last 10 years, that Polish historical research has been confirming what Jewish testimonials from World War II were saying all along, that the overwhelming majority of Polish society was at best indifferent and often actively hostile to Jews trying to hide themselves. The Polish national myth holds it that while a margin of scum and scoundrels might have betrayed the Jews, most Poles tried to help, or at least were sympathetically neutral. This is not what the documentary evidence tells us. But this is how the Poles remembered the period. The Jews remembered it starkly different way. And again, there's very little negotiating ground between the two. If you sit down at the table, listen to what the other guy has to say, you end up thinking, liar, liar. He can't be true. And this, of course, puts debate at a standstill. So why is it that the Polish-Jewish debate has, surprisingly enough, moved forward? We are not where we were 25 years ago. Barbara Kirschenblatt has told you about the surprisingly open and frank debate that surrounded the publication of trailblazing books by Jan Gross about the wartime pogrom in Jedwabne, the post-war pogrom in Kielce. This country has been debating its past with a degree of frankness that I have not seen elsewhere in Europe, bar Germany, but Germany is a special case. What has happened is not that each side has been convinced it might be wrong, but each side has grudgingly come to the conclusion that the other guys might actually be acting in good faith. Make no mistake, they're still wrong. We're right, they're wrong. This is an obvious premise. But because of all they've been doing, we're forced to accept the possibility that they might be innocently wrong. Just poor, deluded guys who don't know better, but they're not evil. They're not vicious. Jewish public opinion has been swayed by the fact that ever since Poland recovered independence and could speak for itself in 1989, there has been a stunning rebirth of interest in things Jewish. We're sitting in one of the practical examples of this rebirth. But actually, a spectacular monument in the nation's capital doesn't impress me. What impresses me is local activists in godforsaken towns, the school teacher, the archivist, the parish priest at times, who have taken an active interest in preserving what remains of the material legacy of Jews who used to live there. A forgotten cemetery, a derelict synagogue. There are hundreds of such people all over Poland who've been spending their time and as often as not their own money to preserve what still can be preserved. If there is no material legacy, then you might have a school teacher sending his children to interview the eldest inhabitants of the town about the Jews. Where they lived, what they did, what were they like. And make no mistake, this isn't Fiddler on the Roof, okay? This isn't cheap sentimentalism. It's not about gefilte fish and Jewish humor. It's about a sense of responsibility. Those people, if they have the patience of answering stupid questions by people like me, so why are you doing this? Well, say, well, look, this is our legacy. We're responsible. Jews have not very often heard in Poland that their legacy is our legacy. But this has been going on so long, so unmistakably, that this has forced a majority, not all, but a majority of Jewish public opinion interested in Poland to revise their thinking about Poles. Now, if the Jewish stereotype of the Pole would be right, then at best, they'd just allow all those buildings to decay and disappear, and probably they would make a national holiday and go smash the remainder of the matzavot and the synagogues because Poles hate Jews, right? Well, it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened. It has forced us Jews to reconsider. And we Poles were forced to reconsider already in the 80s when we had the great underground movement you'll be hearing more about today and tomorrow. And the support it got from abroad almost universally was organized by Polish Jews or their children. The very people who had to flee Poland or had been expelled by Poland were spending their time, their money, and their political influence to help Poland. After 89, Jewish organizations lobbied for Poland in NATO, lobbied for Poland in the EU. It happened so many times that we Poles, grudgingly, against our better knowledge, had to accept that maybe we were wrong about the Jews. Now, this is not a rosy-eyed picture. There's plenty hatred, plenty anti-Semitism, plenty contempt. But this is not the dominant theme anymore. So what has happened? We have been forced, we Poles, we Jews, to accept that even if the other guy is saying nonsense, he's saying it in good faith. That the reason he's saying that nonsense is that he's sadly uninformed, badly uneducated, and otherwise deluded. But it is not that he wants to deceive us or hurt us. This is the fundamental premise of dialogue. Once you accept the other guy is speaking good faith, then everything is possible. You may even agree to disagree because you don't have to stand up for grandfather anymore. What the other guy is saying isn't meant to attack grandfather. You can live with a different vision of history if you don't think of it as a weapon directed against you. And this is the stunning success of Polish-Jewish dialogue. A success that 25 years I would not have believed possible. Now, in a way, this history, which is idiosyncratically Polish, is a banal universal history. Professor Stola yesterday said that we Poles tend to think of ourselves as unique and believe that if you're not born Polish, you cannot understand. But this is run-of-the-mill. This is Turks and Kurds unable to talk to each other, Serbs and Albanians, Israelis and Palestinians, Russians and Ukrainians, you name it. This is not Polish specific. It's sadly human and universal. Last year, I had the privilege of inviting to Poland Professor Halil Berktay from Turkey, the first Turkish historian to publish in Turkish, in Turkey, a history of the Armenian Genocide. And during a debate, he was asked, so why is it that Turkish public opinion refuses to accept evident historical facts? And Halil said, well, you know, I know it's very bizarre, but you see, this is something so specifically Turkish that you really have to be Turkish to understand it. You see, we think that we are innocent. We think that everybody else was doing horrible things, but we and only we are innocent. And I understand it's so weird that only a Turk can understand. At this moment, the audience bursted out laughing. He was describing Poland, right? And Halil turned to me and said, did I say something wrong? The bottom line is, yes, the vicissitudes of this dialogue, the issues being debated, are specifically Polish and specifically Jewish. And yes, you have to have a lot of technical historical knowledge to participate in any meaningful way in this dialogue. But what is at stake is not. What is at stake is absolutely universal. What is at stake is the belief that we need to protect our narrative, our vision of history, because if we want, we will be betraying our people. We'll be betraying the past. We'll be betraying grandfather. This is a universal problem. This is a universal fallacy. The reason why we tend to cling to our understandings of history is that they are supposedly a key to the future. You know, in America, when you say, oh, that's history, it means it's irrelevant. Here, and by here I mean practically everywhere but America. Here, when you say that's history, this means this is of the utmost and immediate importance. Because history explains the present and predicts the future. It is not only that if we Jews would lower our guard and allow ourselves to trust the Poles, we would be exposing us, we'd be betraying the legacy of grandfather. No, we would be also exposing ourselves to terrible danger because you know from history that you can't trust the Poles. And of course, if we Poles would allow ourselves to accept the Jews as equal citizens, it's not only betraying grandfather, but you know you can't accept them. They'll corrupt society from the inside and pervert it and change it into a communist or capitalist or religious or secular or whatever other evil things the Jews do. This is what history has always taught us. History hasn't taught us that we'll be living in the 21st century when the Germans are peace-loving to stupidity. The Jews are warlike to madness. And the Poles have produced a thriving economy, which tomorrow might become the engine of the European Union. I mean, ask anybody in 1950 if he foresees this future, right? But if so, then possibly we can let go of the past. We no longer need it as a matrix of interpreting the presence of the future. It doesn't work. It actually turns out that people change, peoples change, and that the best way to predict the future is to expect change. And if so, we have to say goodbye to Grandpa. He didn't expect change, and unfortunately, he was very right. He expected the worst from everybody and was never disappointed. Just possibly, this is no longer always and uniformly true. Once we accept this possibility, then we can sit down to business. Then it is no longer about you Jews and you Poles. It's about the specific events that happened on a certain day in a certain town. And this we can discuss. This is open to question. It is no longer our identity, our future. For a moment, we can imagine having the luxury of being American, where history is no longer of importance. Now, yes, this is an exaggerated, rosy-eyed picture. True. We're not there yet. We might never get there. But at least it's no longer silly to believe that this could happen. And if so, we actually might have an obligation to the guy sitting on the other side of the table to treat him as a responsible human being acting in good faith and not the perennial enemy out there to get us. And you know what? Miracles can happen. He can actually return the compliment. Thank you. I think we have time for a few questions. Over there. There's a mic coming in.
Over here? Oh, that's better. Hi, I'm Julie Schnur. I'm from 2008. I'm very interested in this idea of respecting the other and agreeing to disagree. And I'm wondering how, with divergent histories, how this plays out in arguments over restitution of property when you really have to come to a conclusion about whose side is right or wrong.
Actually, restitution of property is not about who is right or wrong. It's about who gets restitution and who pays for it. And this is a very different issue. On the issue of right and wrong, everybody agrees. Sure, stolen property should be restituted, right? Now, this is a country which has not passed a law on the restitution of private property. It's the only post-communist country in Central Europe that has not. And there's a very simple reason for it. As you have seen on the map shown by Professor Stola yesterday, half of Poland is abroad and has left its property there. The Polish citizens who live there, most of them, were able to move westwards inside the new Poland. They left their property behind. New Poland, well, one-third of it was Germany until 1945. 3.4 million people were expelled from those German territories to make room for the people fleeing from the east. a bill on private property restitution would not only have to cover the property of Polish citizens as of September 1st, 1939, and their descendants, but also the property of former German citizens expelled after 1945. Bottom line is, if the victims of German oppression want their property returned, they're acting in the interests of the heirs of their former oppressors.